Imagine waking up tomorrow morning, right? You grab your phone off the nightstand, and the first thing you see is this flawless, high-definition video of a major world leader declaring war.
Oh, wow. That is a terrifying thought to start the day.
Right. And I mean, you can see the sweat on their brow. You can hear this slight tremor in their voice.
It looks entirely authentic.
Totally. You watch it three times, your heart is just pounding. But then, maybe an hour later, you find out the entire video was generated by a computer program in like 3 seconds.
Right, the person never even said it.
Exactly. The room in the video doesn't even exist. And,
Yeah.
when you experience something like that, how do you ever trust a screen again?
You really can. Once that trust is broken, it's incredibly hard to rebuild.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. If you are listening to this right now, you are probably the kind of person who doesn't just want to know what is happening in the world. You want to know the actual mechanics behind it.
You want to connect the dots.
Exactly. We want to cut through the noise. And today we have a massive mission. We are going to explore exactly how society went from operating on this shared set of basic, kind of boring facts to living in a completely fragmented multiverse of personalized realities.
It is arguably the most profound shift in human communication since, well, probably since the printing press.
Yeah, that's huge.
And what's fascinating is just how quickly it happened. We are working off a highly detailed source today, specifically Dossier Trump 2015 to 2029. We're looking at chapter six, which is media, disinformation, and alternative realities.
Oh, we really want to stress this isn't just a political story, right?
No, absolutely not. It is a story about human psychology, technology, and like the literal architecture of how we perceive truth.
And we are going to look at it completely objectively. We aren't here to tell you who is right or who is wrong. We're here to look at the machinery.
Just opening up the engine to see how it works.
Right. But to understand the sheer chaos of today's information environment, I feel like we really need to understand what it replaced. Because for a long time, we actually did share a reality, didn't we?
We did, yeah. But we need to define what that actually means. If you go back to, say, the second half of the 20th century, the American news landscape was dominated by a surprisingly small number of organizations.
Like the classic Big Three.
Right.
Exactly. The massive broadcast networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, plus, a handful of major national newspapers.
I always try to picture the sheer scale of that. I mean, you have a country of hundreds of millions of people.
It's massive.
Yeah. You have farmers in the Midwest, you have stockbrokers in Manhattan, you have like surfers in California, completely different subcultures, different economies.
Totally different A. Bailey concerns.
Right. But every single evening, at roughly the exact same time, tens of millions of those people sat down in their living rooms and tuned in to one of 3 half-hour broadcasts.
That is the crucial baseline. And the reason for that, the physical infrastructure of broadcast television required massive, unbelievable.
Oh,
Sure. You need to build the stuff.
Right. You needed broadcast towers, satellites, thousands of employees, international bureaus. Because the barrier to entry was so unbelievably high, it naturally created this bottleneck.
So only a few rich entities could afford to play the game.
Exactly. Which meant they became the ultimate gatekeepers of information.
It's almost like the entire country was gathered in this massive town square. And in the middle of the square, there's just one guy on a soapbox with a megaphone.
That's a perfect analogy.
And, the people in the crowd might completely disagree with whatever policy the guy with the megaphone is talking about. One side of the square might be booing him, the other side might be cheering.
Right, the politics were still fierce.
Right. But at the end of the day, when everyone goes home, they all heard the exact same announcement. The facts were just the facts.
Yeah, that shared baseline was held together by an implicit agreement. Those major news organizations, even though they were fierce commercial competitors, they largely subscribed to the exact same set of journalistic norms.
Like an industry standard.
Right. They went to the same journalism schools. They operated in the same social circles in, New York and Washington. And they fundamentally agreed on what constituted a valid news story.
They shared a methodology for verifying facts.
Exactly. A sturdy shared ceiling.
But I do have to push back a little on this golden age nostalgia.
Go for it.
Was that system actually better for a healthy democracy, or was it just an artificial manufactured consensus?
That's the big question.
Because if you only have three people deciding what the news is, a whole lot of stuff is going to get left out. It feels like an artificial ceiling on reality.
That is exactly the critique that eventually broke the system. You are entirely right. The stability of that 20th century media monolith was really achieved through exclusion.
Right, by keeping people out.
Yes. If those three networks decided a topic wasn't important, it simply didn't exist in the national consciousness. Entire demographics, regional crises, dissenting political philosophies, they were entirely locked out of the conversation because they couldn't get past those gatekeepers.
Yeah. So it was a sturdy house, but it was a very, very small house.
Exactly.
Okay, so the house was sturdy, but small. But then, as the sources detail, as we cross into the 21st century, we don't just expand the house, we blow it up entirely.
Oh, completely. The arrival of the internet completely changed the physics of communication.
It really did.
It altered the fundamental relationship between the citizen and the news. For a century, you know, you were a consumer. You paid for a newspaper or you watch a broadcast.
It was a one-way street.
Right. The flow of information was strictly one-to-many. But the internet introduced a many-to-many model. Suddenly, the barrier to entry just dropped to absolute zero. You didn't need a printing press or an FCC broadcast license.
You literally just needed a keyboard.
Exactly. Anyone could publish information. Anyone could spread news. Anyone could provide commentary and, most importantly, start building their own unique audience.
And what the dossier points out is that this didn't just change who was speaking. It changed the actual DNA of the information being spoken.
It changed the product itself.
Yeah. I remember when getting the news felt like an event. You waited for the morning paper, you waited for the 6 o'clock broadcast. But when the internet decentralized everything, the actual mechanics of a news story shifted.
Drastically.
I want to dig into how the sources describe this, because it wasn't just the same news on a smaller screen.
Mm-hmm.
First off, it got unimaginably fast.
Yes. The transition from a daily publishing cycle to a continuous minute-by-minute cycle completely warped the incentive structure of journalism.
How so?
Well, when you have 24 hours to prepare a broadcast, your primary incentive is accuracy, because you have time to actually check your work.
You can call sources, verify quotes.
Right. But when you are competing with millions of other websites on the internet, the primary incentive is speed. Being first becomes far, far more economically valuable than being perfectly accurate.
Because if you're second, nobody clicks your link.
Exactly.
And if nobody clicks your link, you don't get the ad revenue. It is purely survival. But beyond the speed, the internet made the news highly personal.
Hyper-personal.
Yeah, you didn't have to watch the national broadcast anymore. You could just curate a feed of websites and blogs that spoke exclusively to your specific niche interests.
And that customization inevitably leads to the third major shift the dossier highlights. The emotionalization of news.
Oh, this is a big one.
It really is. When information is scarce, like in the three-network era dry, objective reporting works fine because people basically have no other options.
They'll take what they can get.
Right. But when information is infinitely abundant, dry reporting gets buried. In a crowded digital space, human attention is the most scarce resource on the planet.
Everyone is fighting for your eyeballs.
Exactly. And the fastest way to grab human attention is to bypass the logical brain entirely and strike directly at the emotional brain.
Anger, outrage, fear.
Precisely. The competition for eyeballs meant that nuance was severely penalized and sensationalism was highly rewarded.
So you have a new environment where millions of voices are fighting fiercely for attention using highly emotional, hyper-fast, highly personalized content.
It's chaos.
Yeah, the town crier is just gone, replaced by a million people shouting at the exact same time.
But, you know, this technological explosion didn't happen in a vacuum. You don't just suddenly abandon the old gatekeepers solely because you have a new gadget.
Right, there had to be a reason to leave.
Exactly. There had to be an underlying willingness to walk away from those legacy institutions. And the sources spend a lot of time analyzing this brewing cultural storm, the trust crisis.
This is a critical piece of the puzzle, because as the internet was fragmenting the delivery of news, the American public was simultaneously experiencing a profound systemic collapse in their trust of legacy media.
And it's important we look at this impartially.
Yes, I want to make sure we do that, because it is so easy to assume this was just one group getting angry. But the dissatisfaction detailed in the text was incredibly bipartisan.
The whole spectrum was upset.
Right. The entire political spectrum looked at the center and decided it was broken. Let's look at the conservative critique first. Based on the dossier, why did they walk away from the monolith?
Well, for a large portion of conservative audiences, there was a deeply entrenched feeling that traditional media organizations had developed an overwhelming, undeniable political bias against them.
They felt targeted.
Yeah, or just ignored. They looked at the major networks and newspapers and saw institutions headquartered exclusively in New York and Washington.
Filled with staff who all went to the same elite universities.
Exactly. They felt that these institutions operated as an insulated societal elite. And they didn't just ignore regional concerns, especially the concerns of, say, rural or working class Americans outside the coastal cities, but actually looked down on them.
Right. They felt like it was an exclusive club and they weren't invited.
The perception was that the gatekeepers were actively filtering out stories that mattered to conservative America in order to protect a specific establishment worldview.
And honestly, when you feel like your lived reality is being actively dismissed by the people holding the megaphone, of course you are going to stop trusting them.
Naturally.
But what's fascinating here is that the progressive side of the aisle had equally fierce yet totally different critiques of those exact same networks.
They absolutely did. Progressive groups didn't necessarily attack the media for ideological bias in the same way. They attacked it for corporate corruption.
Ah, the money angle.
Right. They pointed out that these legacy media institutions were massive profit-driven conglomerates. Yeah. They highlighted the extreme concentration of corporate ownership.
Billionaires and multinational corporations essentially controlling the narrative.
Exactly.
It's the argument that, like, if a defense contractor owns a news network, that news network is probably never going to run a serious investigative piece on the military-industrial complex.
Spot on. The progressive critique heavily focused on the idea that the media prioritized commercial interests and sensationalism over substantive reporting.
They just cared about the bottom line.
Right. They felt the networks were more interested in driving ratings, selling pharmaceutical advertisements, and maintaining the corporate status quo than actually informing the public or holding power accountable.
So you have a situation where the right thinks the media is a cabal of liberal elites. The left thinks the media is a cabal of corporate oligarchs, and nobody trusts the product anymore.
The center simply could not hold.
And it is right at this exact intersection, the exact moment where technology makes it possible to completely bypass the media, and the public is practically begging for an excuse to do so, that Donald Trump's political rise occurs.
The timing is just flawless. The dossier makes it very clear that his political success is inextricably linked to these fundamental changes in the media landscape.
Right. He didn't create the environment, but he utilized it.
Exactly. He didn't invent the distrust of the media, but he possessed an uncanny instinctual ability to recognize that vulnerability and exploit it on a scale we had really never seen.
He gave that distrust a incredibly simple, incredibly sticky brand name.
Fake news.
Yeah. Fake news.
Which is really a brilliant piece of rhetorical engineering. Historically, politicians complained about biased news or unfair coverage.
Right. They'd say, you're spinning this to make me look bad.
Exactly. But complaining about bias still implies that the underlying facts of the story are real. You just don't like the spin. By calling it fake news, Trump wasn't arguing about the interpretation. He was challenging the actual existence of the facts.
Wow. He used it aggressively to combat any critical reporting. But the impact went so far beyond just deflecting a bad news cycle.
It reshaped the whole dialogue.
Right. When a sitting president or a major presidential candidate points at the most established news organizations in the world and tells tens of millions of people who already distrust them that they are literally manufacturing lies, it sparks a systemic, society-wide crisis.
It completely forces a debate about the very role of journalism in a democracy. I mean, if the baseline of shared reality is declared fake, then what is real?
Well, human beings abhor a vacuum. If you stop trusting the center, you don't just stop consuming information. You don't just sit in a dark room and twiddle your thumbs.
Oh, you migrate.
Exactly. You migrate. You seek out a new ecosystem that actually validates your concerns. And that leads us to the power of the niche. When the mass media era died, the fragmented media era exploded.
And we really cannot discuss this fragmentation without analyzing one of the most critical players in modern media history, Fox News.
Yes. The sources detail Fox News's growth into the absolute most influential conservative media platform in the United States. And again, stepping back and looking at the mechanics objectively, we need to understand what this network actually built for its audience.
Because it wasn't just delivering the news from a different desk.
Right. What was it?
It provided a sanctuary. From its inception, Fox News recognized the massive, underserved market we just talked about millions of conservative Americans who felt ignored by the legacy networks.
So they filled that void.
They did. Fox didn't just offer alternative political perspectives. It offered an entirely different informational ecosystem.
It seems like a huge part of their success was the meta-commentary, right?
Yeah.
They weren't just reporting the news. They were constantly reporting on how the other networks were failing to report the news.
Oh, absolutely. The institutional critique of the established media was a core pillar of their programming. It essentially validated the audience's pre-existing distrust on a daily basis.
So we're telling you what they want.
Exactly. They put a massive, unblinking spotlight on subjects, cultural grievances, and specific stories that their viewers felt were being actively buried by the mainstream press.
Now, the dossier presents two very distinct ways of looking at Fox News's legacy, and I think we need to unpack both, to be fair.
Definitely.
On one side, you have fierce critics who argue that Fox News was the primary engine of modern political polarization.
Right. The critical argument is that by creating a closed-loop information system where the viewers are constantly told that all other sources of information are lying to them, it becomes impossible to have a national debate.
Because you can't even agree on what's happening.
Exactly. The critics argue that this model prioritized partisan outrage over factual reporting, ultimately fracturing the country into hostile camps that just can no longer communicate.
But the text also requires us to look at the proponent's view, which is essential if we want to understand the modern conservative mindset. To its supporters, Fox News wasn't destroying the media landscape, it was saving it.
Right. Proponents viewed Fox News as a vital, absolutely necessary counterweight to a dominant legacy media that they believed leaned inherently left.
It gave them a voice.
Their argument is quite simple. Before Fox, half the country essentially had no voice in the national dialogue.
And regardless of how you view their editorial decisions, the undeniable reality is that Fox News proved the mass market was dead and the era of hyper-targeted, ideologically aligned media had begun.
The proof of concept was there.
Yeah. And that transition from mass market to niche wasn't just happening on cable television. Right around, like, 2015, another revolution was quietly taking over. And it wasn't happening on screens at all.
It was happening in our headphones.
Yes. The podcast revolution.
The podcast medium is such a fascinating contrast to the traditional television format. If you think about cable news, the entire structure is constrained by time and built for conflict.
You have, what, maybe 3 minutes for a segment?
If you're lucky, you have to fit in a commercial break, you need punchy sound bites, you pit two talking heads against each other, they yell for 90 seconds, and then you immediately cut to a pharmaceutical ad.
It's pure adrenaline. It's exhausting.
But podcasts did the exact opposite. The sources point out that podcasts offered something traditional media thought was completely impossible in the digital age-long form patience.
It's wild to think about. You have a format where someone can sit down with a microphone and tackle the most wildly complex subjects.
Geopolitics, evolutionary biology, economic theory.
Yeah. And just talk for 3 uninterrupted hours. There's no producers screaming in their ear to cut to a break.
And the intimacy of it is just wild.
It really is. When you watch TV, the person is in a box across the room. When you listen to a podcast, that person's voice is literally inside your head.
Right through your earbuds.
Yeah, while you are doing your dishes, walking your dog, commuting to work, it builds this intense parasocial relationship. You feel like you actually know the host. You trust them like a friend.
And that level of trust democratized influence in a way we had never seen before. Suddenly, you had an entire new generation of opinion makers emerging from nowhere.
They didn't need a television network.
They didn't need a satellite truck. A $50 microphone, a decent internet connection, and the ability to hold an interesting conversation were literally enough to build an audience of millions.
It sounds incredibly utopian when you phrase it like that. I mean, free speech, deep thinking, unfiltered conversations.
That sounds great.
But the source material throws a massive bucket of cold water on that utopia. Because while the technology democratized information, human nature kind of got in the way.
As it always does. The downside of endless choice is that humans rarely choose to make themselves uncomfortable.
Right. We like what we like.
The podcast revolution massively increased fragmentation because listeners actively sought out shows that simply confirmed their pre-existing beliefs.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
I always think of it like hosting the most incredible, intellectually stimulating dinner party in the world.
Okay, I like this.
You have an enormous table, fantastic food, and you have the ability to invite a million people to sit with you for 3 hours. But, and this is the kicker, You only ever invite guests who already agree with absolutely everything you say.
Oh, exactly.
Sure, the conversation is deep, but nobody's ever actually challenged. It is just an incredibly cozy echo chamber.
And while podcasts and niche cable networks allowed audiences to actively choose their echo chambers, the next phase of the media evolution took that choice away entirely.
Right. The megaphone and the machine. Because if podcasts were a cozy dinner party, social media was an architectural restructuring of our reality.
The platforms didn't just offer you content, they actively began making decisions on your behalf.
Let's start by looking at what the dossier calls the megaphone. And no platform embodied the megaphone more than Twitter, which is now known as X.
Twitter fundamentally changed the power dynamic between politicians, the press, and the public.
To really grasp this, we have to remember how political communication worked before Twitter.
It was very structured.
Right. Let's say a president wanted to announce a major policy shift. They had to call a press conference in the briefing room. The journalists would show up, they would listen to the announcement, and then, critically, they would ask questions.
They would push back.
Exactly. They would contextualize the statement, maybe point out a contradiction, and then write an article or broadcast a segment. The media was a filter.
Twitter completely obliterated that filter. The dossier details how Donald Trump used the platform to bypass every single traditional structure of political communication.
It was unprecedented.
He realized he didn't need to invite the press to the briefing room if he had a direct digital line into the pockets of 100 million people.
The mechanics of it are staggering when you really break it down. You have a political figure using a social media app to announce major federal policy.
To launch blistering personal attacks on political opponents.
Yeah, to hire and fire cabinet members.
Yeah.
And to communicate straight to the voters, completely unfiltered, at 2 a.m.
And by doing this, he stripped the legacy media of their remaining gatekeeper status. They were no longer the ones breaking the news.
They were just catching up.
Right. A single, short message on a social platform could instantly dominate global headlines and completely reset the daily news agenda. The media was reduced to simply reacting to whatever was happening on the timeline.
So Twitter was the ultimate megaphone for top-down, direct communication. But the dossier argues that Facebook played an entirely different and frankly, much more complex role in our societal fragmentation.
Yeah, Facebook wasn't a megaphone.
Facebook was the machine.
According to the text, for a massive portion of the population, Facebook became their primary default source of daily news. And this is where we have to look under the hood of the technology.
Because the difference between a newspaper and a Facebook feed is the difference between an editor and an algorithm.
Exactly. When I pick up a newspaper, a human being, an editor, sat at a desk and said, "This foreign policy story is the most important thing happening in the world today. Let's put it on page one."
It is a human making a civic judgment about what is important for the public to know.
But an algorithm doesn't care about civics.
Not at all.
We have to understand the specific engineering goals behind these algorithms. They were not designed by journalists to inform the public. They were designed by software engineers to maximize user engagement.
And how do they measure engagement? I mean, what does the machine actually look for?
Through highly specific, measurable metrics, time spent scrolling on the site, the number of clicks on a link, the number of comments on a post, the number of shares.
It's all data points.
Right. The algorithm is basically a mathematical formula trying to solve a single problem. How do we keep this user on the platform for 5 more minutes so we can show them 3 more advertisements?
And what did the algorithm discover? I think of it like going to an all-you-can-eat buffet, right?
Okay, I'm tracking.
But the chef in the kitchen is secretly tracking your heart rate and your pupil dilation. The second your pulse spikes, because you see a jalapeno pepper, the chef immediately clears away all the mild food, all the salads, all the bread.
Oh, wow.
And just starts serving you ghost peppers until you are sweating and crying. The system naturally prioritized the content that evoked the strongest, most immediate physiological response.
That is a phenomenal way to put it. And in the realm of political news, the strongest human emotion isn't joy or contemplation.
No, it's outrage. It is anger.
What's fascinating here is that the researcher cited in the text noticed a very distinct, very dangerous pattern. The algorithm naturally pushed posts to the top of the feed that caused fierce, angry discussion.
Because anger means comments, and comments mean engagement.
Exactly. If an article was calm and objective, nobody commented on it, so the algorithm buried it. If an article was sensationalized, hyperpartisan, and infuriating, people flooded the comments to fight with each other.
And the algorithm saw that high engagement and immediately showed the post to a million more people.
This is such a critical point. The algorithm didn't actually care if the information was true or false, or if it was tearing society apart. It only saw that people were engaged.
Which led to the explicit warnings from researchers. These algorithms actively, systematically fortified polarization.
They created a perpetual feedback loop. If a user clicks on an angry post about an immigration policy, the algorithm doesn't show them a calm analysis of that policy.
It feeds them 10 more angry, increasingly extreme posts about that policy.
Right. It traps users in a funhouse mirror echo chamber of their own beliefs, slowly radicalizing them by showing them a world that appears to be constantly outraged and perfectly aligned with their worst fears.
But wait, I want to play devil's advocate for a second here.
Please do.
Isn't blaming the algorithm essentially taking away human agency? Surely people aren't just mindless zombies clicking on angry posts because a computer told them to. Maybe the world just actually is giving them more reasons to be angry.
That's a fair point.
Maybe the institutions are failing them and social media just allowed them to express it.
It is a phenomenal question, and you are hitting on the core tension of modern media theory. It's really a chicken and egg scenario. Did the algorithm create the anger, or did the algorithm merely hold up a mirror to a society that was already deeply fractured and angry?
What does the dossier conclude?
The consensus among the experts in the text is that it is a symbiotic relationship. Yes, the underlying societal grievances were completely real. The economic anxiety, the distrust of elites, all of that existed before Facebook.
So the fire was already burning?
Yes, but the algorithm acted as a massive accelerant. It didn't invent the fire, but it poured thousands of gallons of gasoline on it by mathematically ensuring that the most extreme voices on any given issue were the only ones that achieved visibility.
Okay, so we have the text-based outrage machine of Facebook dominating the 2010s. But the dossier notes that as we roll into the 2020s, a new giant enters the arena, and it completely rewrites the rules again.
TikTok.
It captured the visual generation.
It became one of the most influential information platforms among youth globally, and it did so by shifting the fundamental medium of communication.
We moved away from text-based articles and angry Facebook comments to short-form video. And the vibe of it is so different. It is driven by deeply personal storytelling.
It's very raw.
Yeah. You aren't reading a 2,000-word op-ed about a political issue. You're watching someone passionately speak directly into their smartphone camera from their bedroom. It feels incredibly authentic, incredibly intimate.
And the algorithmic engine behind TikTok, the For You page, was even more sophisticated than its predecessors. It didn't require you to build a network of friends to show you content.
It just watched you watch it.
Exactly. It just immediately started analyzing how long your eyes lingered on a specific video before you swiped away. And within minutes, it could build a frighteningly accurate profile of your interests, your insecurities, and your political leanings.
The paradox the text points out is fascinating here. On one hand, TikTok made complex political information hyper-accessible to a demographic young voters that traditional media had struggled for decades to reach.
Which is a positive thing for civic engagement.
Right. But on the other hand, receiving your primary political education via a constantly scrolling feed of 15-second emotional videos presents severe new challenges.
The structural questions are immense. First, verification. How do you fact-check a video in real time? Text is relatively easy to parse and cross-reference.
You can search text.
Yes. But a fast-moving, highly edited video layered with trending music and emotional delivery bypasses critical thinking almost entirely. Second, there are the massive questions regarding foreign influence.
Because the company that owns the algorithm has ties to a foreign power.
Precisely. When the black box algorithm that controls the daily information feed of tens of millions of young citizens is entirely opaque and potentially subject to the whims of a rival geopolitical state, it elevates social media from a cultural concern to an urgent national security crisis.
Which brings us directly into the darkest territory of the dossier. Section 4. The weaponization of the feed.
This is where it gets really serious.
Because if you step back and look at the environment we've just described, a fundamentally fragmented public, deeply distrustful of legacy institutions, heavily addicted to algorithmic platforms that prioritize emotional outrage over objective truth, it is the perfect petri dish for bad actors.
It was an open invitation for exploitation. And this is where we have to be incredibly precise with our language. The text draws a very distinct, very important line between two terms that are often incorrectly used interchangeably.
Misinformation versus disinformation. Let's nail these down, because they are not the same thing.
Not at all. The distinction relies entirely on intent. Misinformation is incorrect information that is spread without malicious intent. It is an accident.
Like your uncle seeing a satirical headline on the internet, not realizing it is a joke, and angrily sharing it on his feed.
Exactly.
He believes it is true. He isn't trying to deceive anyone. He is just wrong.
Right. It is a digital game of telephone where the facts simply get mangled in transit. But disinformation is a completely different, much more dangerous phenomenon.
What's the definition there?
Disinformation is a deliberate, intentional, systematically manufactured lie designed specifically to mislead, to confuse, or to manipulate the public.
And the source material highlights that these phenomena don't just happen at random. They explode during high-stakes, highly volatile moments.
Elections, global pandemics, international conflicts, unfolding domestic crises.
When everyone is paying attention.
And when everyone is anxious. These are periods characterized by high anxiety, deep uncertainty, and an overwhelming public desperation for answers. When people are scared, their critical thinking skills diminish, and they are vastly more likely to accept and share information that validates their fear or provides a convenient scapegoat.
It's the ultimate democratic dilemma. Because when the digital town square is suddenly flooded with toxic, intentional disinformation, society naturally demands a cleanup. The public says, "Do something about this. Stop the lies."
But then you run face first into the hardest philosophical questions posed in the entire text.
Because if you demand that someone cleans up the lies, you first have to answer. Who actually gets to decide what the truth is?
And that is terrifying.
Do we want the federal government passing laws declaring what is true and what is false? That sounds like a ministry of truth.
Nobody wants that.
Do we want a tech billionaire sitting in Silicon Valley flipping a switch on an algorithm to decide what millions of people are allowed to see? That sounds like an oligarchy.
Also terrible.
Do we want an independent board of unaccountable experts? Who elects them?
It's a huge problem. How do you aggressively fight coordinated disinformation without moderation inevitably slipping into heavy-handed censorship? How do you fiercely protect the fundamental constitutional right to free speech while simultaneously preventing a society from completely drowning in manufactured reality?
And there is no easy answer. I mean, if I say a certain political policy is a disaster, is that disinformation or is it my opinion?
It's a fine line.
If a platform deletes my post, are they protecting the public or are they suppressing dissent?
And democracies are still deeply, painfully wrestling with these questions. But they do not have the luxury of debating it in a vacuum, because the threat isn't just domestic trolls spreading rumors from their basements.
No, it's organized.
Very. The digital architecture enabled entirely new forms of geopolitical warfare.
Foreign influence and information wars. The dossier goes into chilling detail about how states and non-state actors looked at our digital chaos, looked at our algorithmic echo chambers, and realized the nature of conflict had completely changed.
You don't need to attack a country's power grid to weaken it. You just need to attack its shared reality.
The strategy is remarkably insidious. Foreign intelligence services would deploy vast networks of automated accounts, bought farms, and purchase highly targeted digital advertising.
But not to push a specific foreign agenda, right?
Exactly. That's the wild part. They did it simply to widen existing societal divides within the target country. I remember reading about how they operated during various domestic debates. Say there is a controversial social issue, race relations, or a vaccine mandate.
Okay, hot button issue.
The foreign actors wouldn't pick a side. They would create fake accounts to impersonate the most extreme, aggressive voices on both sides of the issue. They would try to make the left hate the right more, and the right hate the left more.
That is just brilliant in the darkest way possible. The goal wasn't persuasion. The goal was paralysis. They deliberately tried to shatter the remaining trust in democratic institutions, electoral systems, and objective facts.
Because a society that cannot agree on reality is a society that cannot unite to respond to a geopolitical threat.
Information transcended journalism. It became a weapon. Modern war isn't just being fought with tanks rolling across physical borders anymore.
It is being waged right now, invisibly, on the screens we hold in our hands. It is fought with viral videos, weaponized memes, and algorithmic manipulation.
And just as journalists, tech companies, and citizens were slowly beginning to map this new battlefield, just as we were starting to build up an immune system against algorithmic text and social media manipulation, a completely new, historically unprecedented technological tidal wave hit the shore.
The AI wildcard. If everything we've talked about so far was a severe storm, the arrival of generative artificial intelligence was a tectonic earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the period from roughly 2023 onward.
To understand the magnitude of this shift, you have to look at the capability of the technology itself. For 20 years, social media algorithms simply sorted content that human beings created.
Right. It just rearranged the feed.
But generative AI algorithms possess the ability to create the content themselves.
Suddenly, you have systems that can generate incredibly convincing, highly nuanced text. They can write entire articles that sound exactly like a professional journalist wrote them.
They can generate photorealistic images of events that never even occurred.
They can flawlessly clone the voice of a politician with just a 3-second audio sample.
Yeah.
And they can generate full high-definition video.
The dossier details the specific threat of the deepfake. AI made the production of high-quality fake news infinitely faster and astronomically cheaper.
Which changes the whole game.
Completely. Previously, if a foreign intelligence agency wanted to create a fake video of an American official taking a bribe, it required a massive budget, actors, sets, and highly sophisticated CGI.
It was a huge production.
Now, a teenager with a laptop can generate a photorealistic video of the president confessing to a crime using a simple text prompt, and they can do it in 30 seconds.
Yeah. To be perfectly impartial, because the source material is very careful to point this out, AI is a tool. It is not inherently malicious software.
Yeah.
The text mandates that we look at the immense benefits, too.
Absolutely. We have to be fair here.
These same generative systems offer vastly improved data analysis for scientific research. They provide journalists with incredibly fast fact-checking capabilities to parse thousands of documents in seconds. They democratize knowledge to an unprecedented degree.
The medical, scientific, and educational breakthroughs powered by AI are undeniable.
But I keep going back to the scenario we started this whole conversation with.
The video on the nightstand?
Yeah. The dark side of this coin is existential. For the entirety of human history, our ultimate fallback for truth was visual or auditory evidence. Seeing was believing.
If there was a photograph, it happened. If there was an audio recording, the person said it.
But if an AI can perfectly fake a video of a world leader, if it can fake a phone call from your own mother, what happens to the very concept of evidence?
You are identifying the core phenomenon that researchers call the liar's dividend.
The liar's dividend.
Yes. And it raises perhaps the most important question of this entire era. The ultimate challenge that AI presents isn't about copyright law, and it isn't just about the technology itself. It is about the total, unrecoverable collapse of societal trust.
Explain the liar's dividend, because that concept is terrifying.
The liar's dividend occurs when the public becomes so hyper-aware that deepfakes and AI-generated media exist that they stop believing anything is real.
Oh, man. So it flips the script.
Exactly. When a perfectly true, completely authentic video of a politician behaving badly is released, the politician no longer has to apologize. They simply claim the video is an AI deepfake.
And because the public knows deepfakes exist, a massive portion of the population will believe the politician.
So fake evidence is accepted as truth, and authentic evidence is dismissed as fake. The foundational bedrock of reality doesn't just crack, it vaporizes.
Which brings us to the culmination of this immense journey. Section 6 of the dossier, the ultimate question.
We have really covered some ground today.
We really have. We've traced the death of the 20th century gatekeepers. We've explored the rise of algorithmic echo chambers that feed on outrage. We've looked at intentional disinformation campaigns orchestrated by foreign states. And we've stared down the mind-bending reality of AI deepfakes.
And it all leads to the most profound sociological consequence of all this machinery.
Alternative realities. The dossier introduces the concept of parallel information environments.
We are no longer living in a society where people just have different political opinions about the same news cycle. We have reached a point where citizens are living in completely separate, sealed informational spheres.
They wake up and follow entirely different news sources. They trust entirely different sets of experts and scientists.
They rely on completely different sets of historical and scientific facts.
And inevitably, they draw wildly, violently different conclusions about what the world is and what it should be.
What is truly fascinating and deeply concerning is the psychological shift this creates. Historically, in a functioning democracy, two people could look at the exact same set of economic data.
Like a report on inflation, for example.
Exactly. One person looks at the numbers and says, the government needs to heavily intervene to fix this. The other person looks at the exact same numbers and says, no, the free market will correct this naturally.
That is a healthy disagreement of opinion. That is what politics is supposed to be.
Exactly. But today, the algorithmic multiverse has destroyed that scenario. Today, one person opens their feed and sees a deeply reported article explaining how inflation is plummeting and the economy is thriving.
And the other person?
The other person opens their feed and sees a viral algorithmic video claiming that inflation is at record catastrophic highs and the government is actively hiding the real numbers.
They aren't debating how to solve the problem anymore. They are debating whether the problem even exists. They are disagreeing on the fabric of reality itself.
And this is not an isolated American phenomenon. The dossier explicitly emphasizes the global scope of this crisis. It details how governments in Europe, Canada, Australia, and across Latin America are all wrestling with these exact same existential threats.
Every modern democracy is trying to solve an impossible puzzle. How do you regulate massive tech platforms without destroying free speech?
How do you combat deepfakes without creating a government ministry that decides what truth is?
How do you rebuild societal trust in an age of infinite, unverified, AI-generated information?
So we arrive at the text's final, vital, core research question. The question that will define the survival of modern governance. Does a shared reality still exist?
And if it doesn't, can a democracy actually survive without one?
If we synthesize the core argument of the entire dossier, it distills down to a sobering conclusion. Democracy is a remarkably resilient system. It absolutely does not demand that everyone agrees politically.
In fact, it requires vigorous, messy debate to function properly.
Exactly. However, democracy fundamentally requires a baseline agreement on basic facts to allow for compromise.
Because politics is essentially the art of compromise. But you cannot negotiate a budget if you do not agree on what the numbers are. You cannot pass public health legislation if you do not agree on whether a virus exists.
Without that shared baseline, trust vanishes entirely. And when trust vanishes, polarization stops being a political tool and simply consumes the entire system. Information is no longer just the news you read with your morning coffee. In the 21st century, information is the ultimate power to shape reality itself.
And we looked under the hood of Facebook and TikTok to see how their algorithms actively monetized our outrage. We navigated the murky, dangerous waters of coordinated disinformation and foreign psychological warfare, stared down the barrel of the AI deepfake revolution, and finally arrived at the splintered, fragile multiverse of alternative realities.
It is an incredible amount to process, but understanding this architecture, knowing how the machine works, and recognizing when your own emotions are being manipulated by an algorithm is the absolute first step to navigating it safely.
Exactly. So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you go about your day. We spent a long time talking about parallel information environments. If we are all steadily, daily building our own custom, perfectly tailored reality bubbles curated by algorithms that only ever tell us exactly what we want to hear and confirm our deepest biases, how long until we completely lose the vocabulary needed to even explain our reality to the neighbor living right next door?
A haunting thought, but a vital one to consider if we want to find our way back to a shared town square.
But the story doesn't end here. This massive fragmentation of reality didn't just happen by accident. The digital infrastructure we just spent a long time dissecting was designed, built, and owned by some of the most powerful corporate entities in human history. Next time, we are diving into Chapter 7, The Power of Big Tech.
That is going to be a huge one.
We're going to explore the monolithic titans of our age. Google, Apple, Meta, Microsoft, Amazon, Tesla, and X. We will unpack the massive high-stakes debates surrounding platform censorship, algorithmic influence, the true legal definition of free speech in a digital age, and the desperate global search for European tech alternatives. It is going to be an incredible, eye-opening deep dive, so keep your curiosity sharp. We'll see you then.